This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. At the same time we broadcast, we're streaming at prairiepublic.org, and you can always find the show there at prairiepublic.org. We are Main Street, and we are archived forever. And today we're going to talk with a couple of important leaders in our state. Kim Conoco is the executive director of the North Dakota Council on the Arts. She joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Thanks for being with us again, Kim.
Thank you for having us.
And Brenna Gerhart, Executive Director of Humanities North Dakota, sitting right next to you. Thank you for being with us, Brenna.
Excited to be here.
You've got something coming up, Brenna, just this Sunday in Fargo, the Think and Drink. That's an interesting event to spur people in a friendly environment to ponder deep things. Tell us about it.
Absolutely. So it's going to be at the Hodo on Sunday. Doors open at 1:30. It starts at 2 p.m. You can get tickets at humanitiesnd.org. And we're really going to be talking about memory. And we've heard a lot about people removing monuments in the South to Confederate wars or generals. And we're kind of looking at here, how do we remember our pioneers and our past in North Dakota, given that we also have a native population that has been here a long time. I know in Bismarck they're thinking of renaming Custer Park.
Where I live.
Yeah, where you were. Kim's Park. So we're really looking at that issue. What is memory? What does it codify? And how should we have a relationship with monuments and places?
Well, I note that your grant programs, your 2020 special initiative is bias, so that would seem to reflect that.
It fits right in, absolutely.
And then a week later in Dickinson at the Rock's Corner Bar, you will have the same discussion?
We'll have a different discussion. So there we're really going to be talking about our ethical and moral responsibilities to the soil, kind of in light of climate change and those kind of issues.
Ah, meaty stuff.
Yeah.
Kim, you've got an event coming up on Monday, February 24th at the North Dakota Heritage Center. It's one we've featured on our show a few times, actually.
Poetry Out Loud. So we've got 19 schools that are involved and will be at the Heritage Center, and they are open to the public, so we hope that people will join us. In the morning are the first round of competitions between the students, and then after lunch, and it usually is at about 1 p.m., we do the finals, and Humanities North Dakota is our partner on this program.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah, we love this program. I mean, I think it's so exciting for these young people to be exposed to poetry. And somebody said, do they write their own poems? And I said, no, not quite yet. They may be doing that on their own. But they get to choose from a huge roster of poetry, old to new. So it's pretty exciting stuff.
Kim, your organization has had a changing in the chair position, hasn't it?
We have. David White Thunder Trottier has been the chair of our organization for 30 years, and he retired effective January 15th. And he was originally appointed by Governor Sinner, and he was reappointed under Governors Schaefer, Hoven, and Dalrymple. And Burgum.
Wow.
So he's seen quite a few changes. We are sad to see him go, but I think this is a time for David to explore personal adventures. And he will be replaced by Searle Swedland. And Searle actually lives in Valley City, but works at Jamestown Tourism. And he has been on our board since 2017. And on the executive committee since just last year. And so David suggested Searle fill his place as chair, and he will fill out that term. And it's going to be an interesting transition. If people are interested in coming to a big party to celebrate David, we're going to do that in April. And if you want to come or send a note of congratulations or contribute, we're going to get him a big present.
Wow.
Just let me know.
Kim Conoco is Executive Director of the North Dakota Council on the Arts. You can find out more about her organization at arts.nd.gov. And Brenna Gerhart is the Executive Director of Humanities North Dakota. More information about them at humanitiesnd.org. Both of you have publications that are available online. I know the newsletter for the North Dakota Council on the Arts is available there. And you've got something, a substantial publication, Brenna, called On Second Thought Magazine.
Yes, the next issue will be coming out in 2 weeks. If people, it's free to anyone who wants it. You just got to go on our website and sign up. And this is our annual Sense of Place issue. So we just put out a call across North Dakota, and we ask people to send us their best poems, short stories, nonfiction, what have you. And sometimes it's people that have left North Dakota but are nostalgic for home. And we just ask them to share with us what it means to be from here, kind of situate this place in their memory and in the world.
So this is your Sense of Place issue.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a great publication. When it comes, I fondle it. I skim it. I take it home. I read it at bedtime. It's just always very deep and impactful.
Two of you get along, apparently.
We do.
Brenna, you've got a chair. We mentioned the chair for the Arts Council. Elizabeth Sund?
Yeah, in Minot, North Dakota. Yes.
And tell us the relationship of the board to the activities that you do.
So they oversee the activities that we do. Elizabeth actually runs our Minot Think and Drink. It's taking a little bit of a hiatus as we reimagine it. She's a wonderful scholar and a really great moderator and facilitator. But the board basically comes to our programs and tells us if we've done the job right or if we have ways to improve. And of course, they also help us raise funds because it's so critical for us as a nonprofit to keep doing the good work that we're doing.
Well, let's talk about money here. Brenna, how is Humanities North Dakota funded?
Well, we are a 501c3 nonprofit. A lot of people think we're a state agency.
No.
Like my friend here.
Who is banging her head on the wall sometimes.
But we are not. We rely on donations from the general public and grant writing.
And do you have a relationship with the National Endowment for the Humanities?
Yes, we get some of our major grant funding from a grant that we write to the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Kim, how about you?
So we get about $1.5 million as our budget, and 50% of it comes from the National Endowment for the Arts, and 50% of it is granted by the legislature. And there are a few other tiny funds that work into our total, but those are usually the sale of CDs or books, of which we have some wonderful things on our shelves that we would love to share more with people across the state. And we don't write a lot of grants to private foundations, although we are in the process of doing that this year as we undertake some of our bigger programs. And I think the trick is we need to alert our financial partners in OMB that we are asking for funds privately, and then also should we get them, we have to make sure that when we go into the legislature that they are not touched and that they are not an excuse to bring down our funding because we've gotten in additional funds.
OMB, the Office of Management and Budget.
Yes.
And, of course, these are rather lean budgets. I mean, North Dakota has about 770,000 people, and so that's about a buck ahead if half of your $1.5 million is coming from
yes.
the state. It's not a huge amount of money.
It's not a huge amount. We did just finish the strategic review with the governor, and we were asked to really look forward and to be visionary in our approach to the next biennium budget, and we went for it. So we will now have to wait it out and see what happens before the legislature starts next year. But we're really at a point in our organization where we have to be brave and go forward. And it's not about going with our hands out, but it's about really extolling our value and our impact across the state.
Well, when the governor uses the word visionary, that sounds somewhat encouraging.
Yes.
What's your best argument when you're talking to legislators, and for that matter, the governor, about the importance of arts in the state?
I think that we are not always thought of as having a deep value or impacting our state. And when you look at our grant making, we certainly do reach into all corners across the state, into the 8 regions. And our programming shows up with seniors through Art for Life, with vets. We do programs that really highlight the North Dakota cultural heritage through master apprenticeship grants. We give grants to community organizations through Community Arts Access. We're in education through 2 grants and collaborations. We give to individuals through professional development grants and to individual artist fellowships. And then we have a lot of wonderful partnerships, like the grant that we work with Prairie Public, where we're doing special programming. United Tribes is also among them. So I feel like when we make the case, it's also about having established relationships in advance. And I can honestly say that I've done a pretty good job in getting to know many members of the Senate. And I'm working on the House now so that when we go in to have our presentations next year, there is already a sense of that they may actually know what we do.
Well, I should mention, as you did, Kim, that Prairie Public does get some grant support from both of these organizations. Mm-hmm. The overwhelmingly most important part of our funding stream does come from listeners and who become members and support mm-hmm. us that way. And the state provides a small slice of the pie, too. It all makes a difference, as you mm-hmm. well know. Brenna, what is the biggest challenge facing your organization since you are not state-funded?
Yeah. It's definitely finding enough funding out there. But I think an even bigger challenge is just letting people know the value of the humanities. When higher ed gets cut, it's often the humanities and the arts programs that are the first to go. But I think they're so critical for quality of life. They're so critical to the health of our democracy. Our founding fathers really drew upon the humanities as they framed our Constitution. They call on us to keep that a republic if we can. And how do you do that if you don't understand history, if you don't understand ethics, if you don't understand the philosophical underpinnings of our Constitution, if you don't understand how the legal system works, if you're not engaging, if you don't understand civility and civics? And you can't have any of those things without the humanities. That's what the humanities are. So I think our biggest challenge actually is restoring civility to our democracy. And it's an uphill battle, unfortunately, because of the tone of the political rhetoric we have and this idea that we can dispose of the arts and humanities in our education system.
Well, a hearty amen to that from at least this particular end of the state by microphone. Mm-hmm. Brenna, so your organization encourages people to think and think deeply. And Kim, mm-hmm. you're into the creative impulse that we celebrate. I mean, we invent things, obviously. That's pretty important. And imagination is critical to getting, you know, forward in our lives. So the return on the investment for each of these organizations is probably what people are looking at in terms of being, you know, a flinty-eyed analyst about what you do. And you're both making the argument that for a rather modest amount of money, the state's getting a fair amount back.
They are getting their money's worth and more. Yes, for sure.
And we all have this event coming up later this week. Thursday, the 13th of February, is Giving Hearts Day all across the state of North Dakota and into other states as well. That's an important fundraising opportunity for you, right?
It is, particularly for Humanities North Dakota and for Prairie Public and every other nonprofit and charity throughout the state. I wish we could take advantage of it, but all I can say is please consider giving. Support your favorites, support something new, put your pennies where your mouth talks about what you love, and even every little bit really helps.
Well, Kim and Brenna, you're obviously comfortable with each other, and you must occasionally work together collaboratively with your organizations.
Yes, we do. We work together on Poetry Out Loud. Mm-hmm. We also work together on our statewide convening, which is a biennial event. And for us, it's coming up October 7th and 8th, just before
The Game Changer Ideas Festival, which also features art. and humanities.
On October 9th.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. And both of you support other organizations all across the state
absolutely.
With grants.
So let's
talk a bit about that, Kim. What are the grant programs that the Council on the Arts offers?
Well, we did cover a few of them already just in the conversation, but our grant applications are open now. They are online. And what's available right now is Arts and Education Collaboration, Community Arts Access Tiers 1 and 2, and then the Individual Artist Fellowship Program for Dance and Theater. And all of those are due April 1. And then we also have opened the Folk and Traditional Apprenticeship Program, and those are due April 15th. So there's a lot of information out on our website. And probably the two grants that are the most interesting to listeners are the professional development and special projects. So those are both smaller grants. But professional development means that an artist or an individual can go to attend a conference if it's art-related. They can work with a special consultant if they're an organization. And then for special projects, those are small grants that are continuously reviewed so that a community can do something artistic and creative at home with their community of people.
And how are these vetted? Who makes the decision?
We choose panelists to serve every single year, and we look carefully at getting a geographic diversity as well as a diversity of creative expression, and we ask them to fill out a form. We do actually are looking for panelists. If listeners are interested, they can find that information on our website as well. But every single panel, every single grant category has a panel that does that review. And then those that are vetted and going forward with receiving grants then is approved finally by our board of directors.
Brenna, you support Dakota Date Book, that is Humanities mm-hmm. North Dakota
yes,
does,
we
which
do.
We're very appreciative of.
Yeah.
It's a long-running feature on Prairie Public. And, of course, there's a new book out that's the Dakota Date Book mm-hmm. book, we'd like to call it. But you've got grant programs that range from relatively small to those that are a bit bigger. They're not huge. Mm-hmm. Quick grants and other grants, right?
Correct. And we're actually launching a few new grant lines. One is for Think and Drinks. They can be in coffee shops or they can be in a local pub, and we want communities across North Dakota to bring that program in through grants so it's not just in Bismarck, Fargo, Dickinson, and Minot. We're also launching something called Brave Conversations. We want people to start talking about those things that we're too afraid to or that are just hot-button issues. So we're working with a church in town here in Bismarck, and they want to talk about immigration mm-hmm. and refugees because that's a tough conversation we're going to need to continue to have in Bismarck after the vote. And we also have ones for game-changer book discussions. So we bring in these game-changing thinkers, and most of them have books. And so we want people to read and discuss those books and then live stream the Game Changer Ideas Festival into their rural library, wherever that may be. But we also just have a regular grant program. We fund things like the UND Writers Conference, or we're funding an author, Jacqueline Busey is coming to Oaks, North Dakota, and speaking at a church there. So a little bit of everything.
Well, we've had Jacqueline on our show. She's a great interview.
Yeah.
That was Brenna Gerhardt. She's the Executive Director of Humanities North Dakota. More information at humanitiesnd.org. Thank you for being with us, Brenna.
Thank you so much.
And Kim Conoco is the Executive Director of the North Dakota Council on the Arts. More information about her organization at arts.nd.gov. Thank you for being with us, Kim.
We appreciate being here.
And coming up, a little art, poetry from Studio 47.
Hey kids, do you have a story to tell? Enter it in the 2020 PBS Kids Writers Contest. We're looking for amazing original stories from writers in kindergarten through the third grade. So tap into your imagination, break out the crayons and magic markers, and start writing today. When you enter, you'll have the chance to win and see your story published online. First place winners in each grade level will receive prizes and have their stories featured on the Prairie Public website. Everyone who submits a story gets a certificate of achievement. Find the rules and entry forms along with a writer's guide to help you brainstorm and develop plots at prairiepublic.org. Deadline to submit your original story is Friday, March 27th. The 2020 PBS Kids Writers Contest. Enter today.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Poetry from Studio 47 comes to us from Patrick Hicks, writer-in-residence and a member of the English faculty at Augustana University in Sioux Falls. Today, he profiles David Allen Evans.
Evans was born on April 11, 1940, in Sioux City, Iowa. At a young age, he excelled as an athlete. In fact, he went to college on a football scholarship, and in class, he discovered that he enjoyed writing poems. He graduated from Morningside College and went to do graduate work at the University of Iowa, as well as the University of Arkansas. From 1986 to 2006, he was a professor of English and the writer-in-residence at South Dakota State University. He is the author of 15 books, including Real and False Alarms, Hanging Out with the Crows, This Water, These Rocks, The Carnival, The Life, as well as a memoir, Remembering the Sioux. Evans was the Poet Laureate of South Dakota for 12 years, and he has also held fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Bush Artist Program, and he has been a two-term Fulbright Scholar to China. Shortly after his retirement, he was awarded the South Dakota Governor's Award for Distinction in Creative Achievement. Many of Evans's poems are rooted in the Midwest, and he has a sharp eye for capturing details of the world around him. Today we have two poems by David Allen Evans, The Story of Lava and also Neighbors. In the first, he thinks back to his childhood and remembers how his father, who worked at the Sioux City Journal, used lava soap to wash newspaper ink from his hands. For those of you that don't know, lava soap is pretty heavy-duty stuff. It's for real stains on the skin, and it has a gritty texture to it. This is an observational poem. It's about watching someone that you love go about their chores. There is a simple beauty in daily repeated tasks, especially when that person is no longer around, and the repeated chore, which was once so normal, so part of the world, so expected, so routine, is suddenly gone. And so, this is The Story of Lava by David Allen Evans. Every time I smell lava soap, it is 1948. My father is bending over a long sink in the press room of the Sioux City Journal at 5 a.m., his gray, long underwear peeled down over his white belly, a thin bar of lava tumbling over and over, slowly, in his ink-stained hands. The morning news has passed through his hands, out into the morning streets, into the hands of sleepy boys who fold it a certain way and fling it onto porches and steps. But that is not my story. Lava is my story, and the morning news that lava can't rub off. It is my father bending over a sink, a thin bar of lava tumbling over and over and over, slowly, in his cloudy hands. Our second poem of the day by David Allen Evans is Neighbors. It's about an old married couple who have become strangers to each other. This, too, is a wonderful observational poem. This is Neighbors. They live alone, together. She with her wide hind and bird face, he with his hung belly and crew cut. They never talk, but keep busy. Today they are washing windows, each window together, she on the inside, he on the outside. He squirts Windex at her face, she squirts Windex at his face. Now they are waving to each other with rags, not smiling.
Poetry from Studio 47 is recorded at Augustana University and is produced by Peter Folliard. Coming up on Main Street, a natural North Dakota essay about the backyard bird count, a behind-the-scenes look at the Antiques Roadshow Bonanzaville shows, and information about an upcoming webinar on financial abuse of the elderly. First, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. The executive director of the North Dakota Association of Counties says a redesign of county social services is going very well. As of the first of the year, 19 human service zones have been created. Four of those zones are in single counties, Cass, Burley, Grand Forks, and Ward. The rest are collapsed into units of 2 to 6 counties.
As of January 1, all the employees transferred to the host county.
Terry Traynor is the association's executive director.
We have a long way to go. This is an ongoing process, but I think it's going well.
Traynor says the overall goal is to improve services and improve procedures.
There's a number of work groups that are looking at child care licensing and abuse and neglect reporting and all the different functions of social services, and how can we do those more efficiently and move people to the proper services and benefits that they need quicker. And that is ongoing. We've already seen some marked improvement in some of the pilot areas, and as we roll those out statewide, we're very hopeful that we're going to see the same sort of improvement across the state.
A new USDA conservation program that targets farmers in the Dakotas, Minnesota, and Iowa will be rolled out later this year. Its goal is to build soil health in the Prairie Pothole region by paying farmers to plant grass on least productive farmland. USDA Farm Service Administrator Richard Fordrice says the pilot program will take poor quality land out of crop production for 3 to 5 years.
Putting that into some sort of a soil health building or soil health improving cover.
Farmers will also be allowed to harvest the cover crop for hay or use it to graze cattle.
So the idea is that you're sustaining some revenue off of those acres while building soil health.
Enrollment details will be announced later this year. Fargo City Commissioner Tony Gehrig is asking the commission to approve a study that could allow wind turbines to be installed on residential and business properties. Current city ordinances restrict the power generating wind turbines. Gehrig says with the government push on green energy, it's time to make changes.
No, I don't want huge turbines on top of houses that, you know, create a lot of noise or a lot of disruption. But I don't think people do that. For one, it's just far too expensive to do that. Home units are already, you know, kind of a little bit expensive. As the technology gets better, as more communities allow these things, I think the price will go down. But let's allow the free market to answer these questions instead of the government.
Should the commission approve going ahead with a study at tonight's meeting, it would require significant input from a number of city departments before any ordinance changes are recommended to city leaders. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
Giving Hearts Day, a 24-hour fundraising event in North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota, is happening on Thursday, February 13th. We hope you'll consider giving to Prairie Public. You can schedule your Giving Hearts Day gift to Prairie Public today by going to prairiepublic.org/GHD.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The Great Backyard Bird Count uses volunteers across the country and around the world to help scientists evaluate the environmental conditions for birds. Our Natural North Dakota essayist Chuck Lura is one of the backyard birders who takes part, and today he explains how the count is conducted and where you can find the results.
It's that time again. The Great Backyard Bird Count's coming up next weekend, Friday, February 14th through Monday the 17th. It's a joint project of the Cornell University Lab of Ornithology and the National Audubon Society. As many of you know, it's an effort in which amateur birders can help scientists better understand the population dynamics and movements of birds. Those of us that watch birds have noticed that the abundance and diversity of bird species in and around our homes and feeders during the winter can be quite variable. Scientists are trying to get a better understanding of these differences, and with our help, they can obtain some real-time data on where the birds are each year during 4 days in February. You don't need to be a bird expert, and participating is easy. As their website notes, participating is as easy as 1, 2, 3. You just count the birds in your area for at least 15 minutes for as many of the days as you like, count the greatest number of individuals of each species you see during that time. When you finish, submit your results. Since its inception in 1998, this citizen science project has become quite a successful venture, with participants around the world submitting checklists of their observations. Last year, participants documented the whereabouts of nearly 7,000 species in over 100 countries. Here in North Dakota last year, volunteers submitted over 200 checklists from several locations across the state, documenting the abundance of over 60 species ranging from long-eared owls near Dunn to a deer falcon and its northern flickers and robins. Yes, some robins seem to stay around our North Dakota winters. But checklists were only submitted from 29 counties, so there's lots of gaps in the whereabouts of our birds. You can find the Great Backyard Bird Count website through your computer search engine. Plus, I put a link to the website along with the text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access it at prairiepublic.org. Either way, you'll find all the information necessary to participate, as well as lots of good information on the project and birds in general. So consider participating in the Great Backyard Bird Count this year. Not only will you enjoy some good bird watching, but you'll also be helping scientists better understand the winter movements of our feathered friends. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
NPR Music wants to hear your songs. If you're an unsigned musician, enter the Tiny Desk Contest. Just send us a video of you playing an original song behind a desk by March 30th. Learn more at npr.org/Tiny Desk Contest. Thank you for joining us today for Main Street on Prairie Public. Over the past few weeks, we've aired interviews from the Antiques Roadshow stop at Bonanzaville last June. The final show of the three Bonanzaville episodes airs this evening on our television service, and it will be followed by Prairie Public's Behind the Scenes feature. Here's an interview Ashley Thornburg did for that show as she visits with line producer Jill Giles.
Jill, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
What is a line producer?
One of the things I do as a line producer is select the items to go on television. Mm-hmm. When we have the events here, I'll kind of listen to pitches and make a determination of whether we want to film it or not and how we want to film it.
How do you make that decision? Do you kind of go with your gut? Do you go with research? Is there geography? Like, something North Dakota specific?
Well, we have a lot of input from our appraisers who are the experts. So they'll tell us, you know, this is really great. We haven't seen one of these, and give us some details on it. And, you know, this is different because, and this is some educational information I can give. You know, maybe the person knows a little bit about the artist, but they don't know the auction records or something like that. We'll listen to what the appraisers have to say, and then we'll interview the guests and see how would they be on TV. Are they really talkative? Is there something that they're going to learn from this? And then we'll kind of say, is this going to be a shorter segment or a longer segment, and how do we want to film it? Been doing it a while, so it kind of comes naturally now.
How hard is it to keep a poker face when you're dealing with these people and they don't know why they've been picked to be on TV, if they're about to learn that grandma's priceless heirloom is really not worth anything, or they're about to learn that this thrift store find is $100,000? You have to poker face this.
I do. It's super easy, though, because I feel like we're giving them information no matter what. Okay. So even if it's a letdown, at least we know that we're educating the viewers at home. So if they have this, then they'll also know. And we try not to embarrass anybody, so it's always going to be a gentle letdown.
How'd you pick Bonanzaville?
Well, we had a lot of people from North Dakota that were been writing and calling us, telling us that we needed to come. So we've been listening to them. And when we moved to this new format where we film outside, we had said, do you have any places there? And they said, yes, we do. Mm-hmm. And it's Bonanzaville. And we immediately got onto the internet and started looking around. And they have a great 360 video where you can basically drop into any building and all over the streets and take a virtual tour. And we all fell in love with it immediately. And we were like, this is going to be great for the show.
And then your impression when you actually got here, did it meet your online expectations?
Absolutely. I mean, for us, it's just the size of it is perfect. There's just so much charm. There's so many different angles where we can film. There's so much history. I mean, it's just like the history of North Dakota in one spot. You guys have done a really good job preserving these buildings and all the artifacts. And it was kind of a no-brainer. It's really perfect for Roadshow.
What are some of the challenges of shooting outdoors? You haven't been doing the outdoor venues very long.
Yeah, sometimes we get highway noise.
Wind.
Sometimes there's an airport nearby where I heard people will be doing parachuting. Mm-hmm. So we have challenges with that. Rain. We've dealt with rain and weather and just terrain and where can we set up that we're going to be on level surfaces for our guests to be and make sure it's accessible. There's new challenges everywhere. Those are the ones we've found here.
What is a typical day like for somebody who comes to Antiques Roadshow with an item? What's that process that they go through?
So they've already won their tickets, mm-hmm. and they have them on their phone, and they can just show them when they show up. And then they will kind of queue up in a line if they get here early. Then they get a little event guide that tells them all information and maps and what to expect and frequently asked questions. They can kind of peruse that while they're waiting. And then they go to an area called triage where their items are categorized. So they might have like a piece of silver and a book, and they get a ticket for each. And then they are led into the appraisal areas, and they go to their first category, then they go to their second category. And if their item is chosen for television, they have to wait a little longer to be filmed. And if not, then they can just kind of follow out to our exit areas where they can have refreshments and stop by the Prairie Public Television station, get a little prize for signing up to give their email, and then they can stop by our feedback booth, where if they didn't get on TV, they can still stand in front of the camera and be able to say something, and then we'll use that under our credits, and then they leave. So typically people hear about 2 hours.
How about for the staff and the volunteers here? What are their days like? Because obviously a lot more than just Saturday, June 1st.
Yeah. We work pretty hard when we're on site, come for a meeting that takes a few hours the day we arrive and kind of review the last shots and tent placement. And then we're here before sunrise, actually. We were here this morning around 6 a.m., setting up, getting our cameras ready, testing all of our equipment, running power everywhere. Then we do a rehearsal in the afternoon, train all our volunteers. And then on event day, we're all here at 6 a.m., getting all of our police and security in place. And then we'll record from 7:30 until the last person leaves, 7 o'clock. And then we'll stay after everybody has left and pack everything back up. And we roll our trucks back out somewhere around 10 or 11 o'clock at night.
Long days.
Long days.
Lots of coffee and donuts, huh?
Exactly.
Will you be looking for any sort of regionally specific items? Like Theodore Roosevelt obviously spent a lot of time here before his presidency. We have a number of indigenous peoples here, and the tribal arts, big in the appraisal section. Do you look for regional specific with your appraisals and what gets picked for TV?
We don't generally look for it, but we just have an idea of what things will likely turn up. So we would expect a lot of tribal artifacts here. Also, there was a lot of people who moved, immigrants who came, so we're going to look at we're going to be seeing a lot of painted chests, a lot of needlework samplers, a lot of quilts, you know, things that you brought with you when you traveled west. So those are things that we just might staff a little bit more to make sure we have enough people to look at those items. But really, when people move, they take their most precious items with them and just don't know what that's going to be. So we can see anything.
How important are volunteers to Antiques Roadshow?
Oh, we really could not do this without our volunteers. They are the face of Roadshow on the event day. All of us are kind of behind the scenes working really hard, and the volunteers are the ones that greet everybody, that help move the crowd through, who answer all of our questions. That's why we spend a lot of time training them today. But when you come as a guest to Antiques Roadshow, you're basically going to interface with a volunteer. So it's really important that they can represent us in a good way, and they usually are fantastic.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
That was Antiques Roadshow line producer Jill Giles with our Ashley Thornburg. The final Bonanzaville episode will air tonight at 7 Central, and the Prairie Public behind-the-scenes look at the show will follow at 8 Central. Next on Main Street, a webinar about financial abuse of the elderly.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
When Kate Devlin visited a sex doll factory for the first time, she expected to be disturbed.
I went there thinking, I'm not going to like this reductive stereotype of a woman.
But when she saw the dolls in person,
I hadn't been prepared to see these as works of art in their own right, which they really are.
Silicone Lovers and Silver Linings, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by Jane Strawman. She's an NDSU Extension Gerontology Specialist. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
And we're here to talk about an upcoming webinar that deals with elder financial abuse. But before we do that, Jane, how would you describe your work as a gerontology specialist?
Oh, well, with the NDSU Extension, our purpose is around educational outreach to the community, citizens across the state of North Dakota. And so I get to work in all areas impacted by older adults or their family members, wellness, you know, their physical health, social health, mental health, financial health, all those different areas. And I really respond to what's happening out in our state, what our county extension agents are seeing, and we try to address the issues that are most important to our citizens.
Well, I now fall under that description, so I guess I should listen closely. But if I pick up the newspaper, typically I will see a headline in there about somebody who has really been robbed, an older person typically who might be vulnerable because of their age or other circumstance, and their life savings are suddenly gone. So we're talking about a real issue here.
Absolutely. It's a big issue all over, you know, nationally, and it's so underreported as well.
Yeah, and devastating, especially near the end of life. This Elder Financial Abuse webinar is coming up Wednesday, February 12th at noon Central Time. It's hosted by NDSU and the South Dakota State University Extension, so this is a joint offer.
Absolutely. We have been partnering with SDSU Extension. We offered some webinars last summer, fall, and we just started up again last month, and so we're running some seminars now, and it's been a great partnership to do these things, and we have a broader audience, and of course these topics impact people no matter what state you live in.
And of course we've been around the internet now for a long time, almost a generation, so older people know their way around it typically as well. A webinar is a seminar that's available online.
Absolutely, and people can ask questions in a chat box, and so we can try to get their questions answered as well.
So what will be covered in the upcoming webinar about elderly financial abuse?
Yeah. Well, we're very pleased to have the Assistant South Dakota Attorney General, Kimberly Zacherson, on. And she is going to be talking about elder financial exploitation or abuse. You can kind of use those words interchangeably. But she's really looking at not the normal kind of stranger fraud and scams that we hear about. There's a lot of information that's available to consumers about that topic. AARP of North Dakota and other organizations are doing lots of education across the state on helping older adults really be aware of those types of scams, those stranger things, stranger scams and frauds. So this webinar is really talking about some of those other types of financial abuses that can happen from other individuals, and those individuals could really be anyone. They could be professionals that you know. They could be a caregiver, a casual acquaintance, and unfortunately, and often a family member.
Yeah, that's the part that is especially bitter. So often the culprits are people that you would rely on.
that you know and that you trust.
So how are elderly people most likely or often likely to be abused financially?
Well, we look at, you know, like who would be most at risk for financial abuse. And really, it can happen to anyone, regardless of age or race or income, religion, those types of things. But what we've seen is that most typically they would be female, very old, you know, maybe socially isolated, living alone, and often having some kind of limited capacity mentally. For example, having some dementia. They might have physical impairments that restrict their mobility or their ability to care for themselves. And those are people that we see that are more likely to be victimized.
And, you know, I'm of a certain age. I have extended power of attorney to my son. It's not an unusual thing when you get to a certain age and you worry about if the circumstances come up and you become incapacitated, how will my assets be handled? And that is a big piece of trust right there.
It is. It is. We want people to plan ahead for their later years and to the idea that maybe at some point a person might not be able to handle their financial affairs. It's really important to do that advanced planning, whether it's for your healthcare needs or for your financial needs. And you need to have somebody that you trust in those situations to be able to manage your affairs and your financial affairs.
Yes, because we're talking about financial affairs, and we can also be talking about health maintenance as well.
I mean, correct.
When do I want the plug pulled, for example?
Yes, absolutely.
that kind of thing. But looking at financial issues here, in the process of this power of attorney issue that I just went through, I came to understand that there are variations of it, that there are some powers of attorney that are all-encompassing and others that are more limited.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. I'm not an expert on the legal side of things or the types of different power of attorneys, but I do know that it's really important for the older adult to know what kind of arrangement they want, to have that very clear. And I think that probably the most important thing as we look to educating people about how do you prevent this from happening is having those open conversations with your family members about how do you want your financial affairs handled if you're not able to at some point. And making it, normalizing the conversation about talking about these possible things, that somebody could have their be a victim of financial abuse, that that's a normal conversation. So having that conversation within one's family and having it directed by that older adult and having their wishes known to their family, often their adult children, but to be very transparent and about what their wishes are. Because that's what we want to do as adult children. We want to be able to carry out the wishes of our parents. So I think it's really to be clear how they want things handled.
How can people access this webinar?
You know, they can go to the NDSU website. There's a registration process. And we're using the process through SDSU University called Eventbrite. But easiest way to get there is to look at going to ndsu.edu/aging/webinars. And then you'll see this financial webinar that's going to be offered next Wednesday.
So ndsu.edu/aging/webinar.
Correct.
And is there a fee for it?
No, there's no fee, but we do ask that people register, and you need to register by noon the day before on February 11th. We like you to register so that we can send you a reminder and also that we can follow up if there's any handouts or information afterwards. We'll have your email and we can send you an evaluation as well. So there's no cost, and we welcome people to join and learn a lot about the tips and tricks about strategies to avoid and preventing these types of financial abuses that we know are happening and often so underreported.
Well, we can also tell you that this show is archived. It's broadcast live. It streams live at prairiepublic.org. But at that same place, prairiepublic.org, if you click on Listen, that's the radio side of Prairie Public, and our show, Main Street, after the show is broadcast, it is archived, and this address will be available at the Main Street Archive for this particular program. So people can find out that as well. Will the webinar be archived? Can people watch it after the fact?
Yes, at the same web address that I just gave you under webinars. We have upcoming webinars, and then we also have archived webinars as well. It might take a couple weeks, but we'll get it up there.
But the advantage of registering and watching it live is that you can interact.
Correct, absolutely. We've had a great response to this webinar. We have a lot of people registered, so it might be limited as far as interacting, but we're just welcoming people to take part and learn what they can about this really important topic.
Well, Jane Strauman, thank you for dropping by today.
Thanks for having me.
Jane Strauman is with NDSU's Extension, and she's a gerontology specialist. We're talking about the Elder Financial Abuse webinar that's coming up Wednesday, February 12th at noon Central, hosted by NDSU and SDSU Extension. Coming up next, Dakota Date Book.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. In Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 10th. In the early days of Great Plains settlement, fire was a threat. Driven by the wind, it could sweep across grasslands and crops. It might be started by lightning or human error. Fires deliberately set to burn off vegetation could get out of control. The threat extended to settlements. With wooden buildings close together, fire could destroy a large city as easily as it could destroy a small town. In 1893, a fire roared through Fargo. The fire quickly spread from the Little Gem restaurant to nearby buildings. When the fire reached a gun shop, gunpowder and cartridges exploded. Strong winds fanned the flames. The Fargo Argus newspaper noted, "Hell itself could not have presented a more terrible picture." By the time the fire was extinguished, there was little left but ashes. 95% of the city was gone. On this date in 1905, North Dakotans learned that a former Devil's Lake resident had found a way to resist the danger. A devastating fire had hit Esterville, Iowa, but the Davis Building remained standing. It was constructed of concrete blocks from the company of former North Dakotan L.L. Bingham. Insurance agents investigating the fire were amazed that the Davis Building withstood the heat of the fire. The water sprayed on the building froze in the winter temperatures, but the building remained unscathed. It was even undamaged after a three-story building collapsed against it. Wooden buildings erupted in flames, and brick buildings could not endure the fire and the freezing water. But the concrete blocks of the Davis Building showed almost no sign of damage. Concrete blocks were first manufactured in America at the turn of the 20th century. They were formed in wooden frames and dried like bricks. In 1900, Harmon Palmer patented a method of creating the blocks that are familiar to us today. The hollow form of the blocks retained strength while reducing weight. These concrete blocks were featured and promoted at the 1904 Louisiana Purchase Exposition, bringing them to the attention of the entire country. Not surprisingly, insurance companies encouraged their clients to use concrete blocks for new buildings. This did a great deal to mitigate the damage of fires, and a North Dakotan had a hand in this valuable innovation. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Following the muddle in the Iowa caucuses, Democrats have moved on to New Hampshire, where some candidates are calling for unity.
We have one job, and that is to beat Donald Trump in November. And to do that, we're going to have to pull our party together.
Who will emerge as the frontrunners, and can the party avoid another vote-counting debacle? That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, we'll talk with filmmaker Dirk Wieringa, who's documenting life along U.S. Highway 2 from Michigan to Montana. He expects to complete his film titled Route to Elsewhere this year, and he'll join us from our studio in Grand Forks. And Friday is Valentine's Day. Horticulturist and wine enthusiast Ron Smith will join us to talk about flowers, wines, and some tips on starting plants early for spring. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.